Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. Hello. Welcome back to Hey Kids Comics, The Return. We're on about episode 8 and 9 now.
Are we?
I think we've returned.
We have returned.
No, it's only so long
that
you can keep banging on about The Return, isn't that real? It's like Cocoon.
Season 3 of Twin Peaks, that was called Twin Peaks The Return, wasn't it? What was that?
How many episodes was it?
15 episodes, something
like
that?
Yeah, but after 5, you're kind of like, you've returned now.
Yes. In true Lynchian fashion, they stretched it, pulled it. So
I think we're past the whole turn thing.
So what are we now? Hey Kids The Returned?
Yes.
Hey Kids Reborn?
Hey Kids, You Can't Get Rid of Us.
Yeah.
Try as you might.
Like a turd that won't finish.
Yes, I am Andrew Leyland.
Oh, and I'm Michael Leyland.
Yeah, we didn't introduce ourselves in last time's episode.
Well, people know who we are. They have come to expect the highest of quality of podcasting entertainment. But only we need no introduction. We certainly don't need to introduce ourselves.
I kind of think that if they've come for any of that, they're going to be a little bit disappointed. But anyway, tonight, today, tomorrow, and always.
Yeah.
What Smith song was that?
I don't know.
I don't. Today,
was it a Smith song? Or can you just say
my only weakness was a listed crime.
The
last time the war was all I saw on Channel 4. Shoplifters of the world. Shoplifters of the world unite and take over.
It is. Yeah.
Took us a minute.
I kind of feel like that could have easily not been a Smith song. If you just say nonsense and kind of drone it out a little, it just sounds inherently Morrissey-esque.
It sounds like somebody whining.
Which is the Smiths. Let me cry into my microphone for 40 minutes while Johnny Marr jingles on his guitar behind
me. Like you've got a whining, but Johnny Marr adding his little twang.
Yeah, exactly.
Just makes it palatable.
Yeah.
It's perfectly acceptable.
Crying on the moors.
Oh, come for the 40-year-old pop culture references.
Finger, as always, on the pulse.
Yeah, well, so Johnny Marr was on Have I Lied? Would I Lie to You recently?
Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, Would I Lie to You, right? Okay.
Da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
With Lee Mack and
right.
Rob Brydon and David Mitchell.
Is that still going?
Yes. Right. And I will tell you for why. Are you interested in for why?
I mean, go on.
Okay. I mentioned earlier
right.
the Richard Osman's podcast.
We're doing this again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Somebody emailed him and asked him as a noted person about town in the television industry.
Yeah.
Why did Mock the Week and Question of Sport get cancelled?
Right.
But other shows continue.
Okay, yeah.
And he said, right, well, there's three metrics by which these are measured nowadays. There's your overnight figures, which are still quite important for certain kinds of shows. Then there's your long-tail programming.
Right.
How does it perform over 7 days, 14 days, 21 days, and ultimately years?
Yeah.
And overseas potential.
Right.
In sales or sales of that format.
Okay.
Okay? So, Mock the Week.
Yeah.
Was a comedy panel show,
yep.
of which there are many.
Yeah.
About topical news events,
yep.
of which there are many.
Yeah.
Therefore, had no resaleable potential because it was British news.
Yeah.
It had no rerun value because
it's topical.
It's topical and wasn't carrying itself in the overnight. So.
Right. Because I'm going to say it's always on reruns.
Yes.
It's constantly being rerun.
But it doesn't work.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen, oh, it's an old one, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because it's not topical anymore. Same with the Question of Sport. It's always about sport events that are happening right now.
Yeah.
It's the format may be sellable to other countries, but as a show in of itself, that's not going to sell to other countries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was down to 2 million viewers for the chop.
Right.
Would I Lie to You? Been on the air for 15 years at this point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you can watch an episode from series 2 of that, not series 1, because Angus Deaton hosted it.
Okay, right.
So that instantly dates it.
Yeah.
But from when Rob Brydon took over, other than obviously the respective ages of the people involved.
Well, I suppose the fact that also one of the main cast members is dead now as well. So that.
Oh, Would I Lie to You?
Which one was Ian?
Who?
8 out of 10 Cats. Was
out of 10 Cats. Sean Locke is
dead. That's it. Yeah. Okay.
But 8 out of 10 Cats is another one. It's like, does it have any of that stuff? But Would I Lie to You? You can show them an episode from 10 years ago and show an episode from yesterday. And other than the beards and greying and ages and stuff, it still plays.
Yeah.
Because there is no topical references in it.
Right.
Osmond said he recently did a book tour.
Yeah.
And you know what people want to talk to him about? Being on Taskmaster.
Right.
Okay. Taskmaster travels.
Right.
The entire world that have seen it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you could go to some nobody in the middle of Iowa. So have you ever seen Taskmaster? But the people that have seen it love it.
Right.
So it sells all over the world, Taskmaster.
Okay.
And it can be episodes from 10 years ago or today.
Yeah.
And because there's no topical references in it,
it
still
works.
Plays.
Yeah.
So you're glad you asked that question now, aren't you? And got that long-winded answer about stuff which you really don't care about. But it does play into today's topic of the Doom Patrol, which has frequently had its title cancelled from under it. It never really found its audience beyond its initial run.
We very are the masters of professional accidents.
And the thing with that as well is that just suddenly came to me. That's not written down, is it? I've not written that segue down. So, this is why they come. Happy accidents are us. That's what we're going to call it. But first, before we do any of that, lovely listener, it's email time. Jingle, jingle, jingle. Email time for email, email time. Which is a dead medium, apparently. Maybe you should all send us TikToks.
Well, I'm thinking, because we only ever get the one now, and they are always from Michael Bailey.
Hi, Mike.
Part of me does think that instead of him sending us an email, he should just send us
TikToks.
Or a voice clip. And so that we can, like, an old TV show, we can have, and now we go over to the weather. Now we go over to
Mike with the email.
Billy on the street, and here's Mike with this week's email. He just does it via voice message.
Maybe he just likes hearing our dulcet, guttural tones. Murder. His syntax.
I mean, I would love to hear someone else butcher my emails.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe there's a sense of masochism that comes into it.
Maybe.
But we love email. So if you want to be like Mike, send us an email. Only Mike sends us emails. I don't understand. It takes effort, though. You've got to sit down. You've got to type it out.
Maybe this is the harsh awakening that we only actually have one listener. And even then, it's only because he's your best mate.
Yeah. There is that. I'd not considered that. Right, thanks for ruining me there. Going Ape, Michael Bailey's. Oh, it'll be Star Trek Apes.
It will,
yeah. Cool. Andy and Mike, hey.
All back to normal.
Back to normal. Crossovers are a mixed bag, but it's nice to hear that the meshing of the original Star Trek and Planet of the Apes went down for both of you. My favourite part of the episode was when y'all started geeking out hard about how this story fits into the continuity of the two properties. Did I understand most of it? Mainly because I've never seen any of the Planet of the Apes films outside of the Tim Burton remake. Oz, while Andy sputters in disbelief. I'm going to say that again. Because I feel that I didn't quite give it the import that such a ridiculous statement.
You need to deliver such a line of gravitas.
I've never seen any of the Planet of the Apes films outside of the Tim Burton remake.
It's a bold statement. It's a bold thing to own up to as well.
I mean, fair play to him to have been people like, to be brutally honest.
Exactly, yeah.
That not only has he never seen any of the Planet of the Apes, which you could kind of forgive.
Yeah.
I don't know how, because they were on TV all the time. Certainly when I was growing up. He's not much younger than me. And American television plays stuff to death, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So they must have heard on TV. But the only one you've seen is arguably, not even arguably,
yeah,
is quantifiably, objectively, the worst of the Apes films.
Right.
But he's almost, and this is a bold statement, the worst Tim Burton film. I'm struggling to think of a worse Tim Burton film.
I don't think I've seen enough Tim Burton films to kind of weigh in on that. And I've actually not, I've not seen the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. At least in,
well, that's just, that's a perfectly acceptable statement to make in public.
I feel like I should. We've just seen, me and Dana have just seen all the Planet of the Apes films, and I feel like we need to see Marky Mark in front of Abraham Lincoln.
No, you don't. You can skip from the original cycle of five movies,
yeah,
and go straight to the three modern remakes, because the three modern remakes are, for my money, the finest example of rebooting an old franchise ever.
Okay.
Better than the Star Trek ones.
Right.
Certainly better than the Star Wars sequels.
Right.
Maybe Battlestar Galactica was as good, but that's not a film.
Yeah.
So I don't know that.
Well,
that helps.
We will watch those ones next.
Yeah. But no, don't. Just save yourself 2 hours of your life.
I don't know. Maybe I can kind of justify it. But if I drink,
you're drunk.
If I drink so much that I black out and don't remember the night before, I can say that I've seen it.
Then.
You know, I can have set, I can add it to my list of films I've watched this year and then, you know, not have to remember any of it.
Anyway. Well, it's a bold statement to make in public, Mike. I can explode. Good. This should be fun. Can explain. I am the youngest child in my family and I have three older sisters. And while they would introduce me to all kinds of cool things like horror movies and Stephen King books and all that, when we were kids, television time was at a premium. So I had to take my shot when I could, which meant I tended to stick to the superhero stuff I loved. Plus, as I recently found out when I came home and my dad was watching one of the recent Apes films, my dad did not like Charlton Heston. So the Apes films were never on my radar. Well, he's only really in the first one. It's Burly in Beneath.
Yeah.
He's in, like, what, 2 minutes at the beginning and 5 minutes at the end.
Maybe that'd be a good one to watch, you know. If you don't like a guy, you get to see him blow up then. Yeah.
Well, no, if you don't like the guy, the best one to watch is the third one.
Yeah.
Watch Escape from the Planet of the Apes, which is easily the best sequel to the original Planet of the Apes in that five-film cycle.
Yeah.
There's no argument there. No. That's not a controversial statement, surely, that the third one's the best one of the sequels. That's a topic for conversation, though, isn't it? Cool, if we did a movie podcast,
okay,
which this is rapidly turning into. Which franchise has a great first film and the rest just coasted on that film for the rest of it? And you could wipe them all out of existence and it would not matter. I mean, the obvious answer is Jaws.
Yeah, Predator.
Predator, possibly, but Prey was really good.
Controversial. Terminator.
No, that's not controversial. Because Terminator, the first Terminator is a brilliant film.
Yeah.
Perfect film.
Yeah.
And the sequels are completely unnecessary, including the TV show, which is where Highlander falls down. Because the TV show did it better than the films.
Yeah.
But you don't get the TV show without the films.
Yeah.
So you have to suffer through Highlander 2, the quickening, and Highlander 3, the whatever the hell that
was. The slowing it.
Yeah. And Highlander 4, let's bring the TV guy in, but it'll be a bit crap because Christopher Lambert looks very, very, very old now for an ageless immortal.
Right, okay.
And Highlander 5, they made a Highlander 5.
They did 5?
Yes.
Had a TV show.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you've got to have all of that to have the TV show.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate. I mean, yes, the answer is Jaws. But where do the Planet of the Apes and the Die Hard films fall in that? Because, all things considered, the Planet of the Apes movies maintain a relatively decent bar of quality. The second one's good, but not great. The third one is great. And then the fourth and fifth one are both kind of, they're right. They don't suck the room. But then the remakes are brilliant.
Right.
Okay. So, and then Die Hard 2 is much better than it's got any right to be.
Die Hard 3 is the best.
Die
of
Hard
of
Vengeance
them.
Is easily the best sequel. It's not the best, but then Die Hard.
Yeah.
But Die Hard 4 isn't completely suck-worthy.
See, I haven't seen any past the original three.
They're all on Disney, because you've got Disney and I don't. Not that I'm bitter about that. I watched all five of them last year.
Yeah.
I watched, obviously, my regular Die Hard at Christmas. Realised Die Hard 2 is also a Christmas film.
It is.
And then carried on with them. But easily, the best sequel is the third one. Yeah. Undeniably.
But no,
the fifth one's not very
good. Well, weren't the other ones when they came out after Jason Statham movies were big, so Bruce Willis was like, I can see some money in this.
Probably.
Yes.
But you can't compete with the Statham. We've watched 4 Statham movies this week.
That's true. Have you seen The Beekeeper yet?
We have not seen The Beekeeper yet, but I'm very much looking forward to The
I've
Beekeeper.
Heard, so he works for the organisation called The Beekeepers, and they work for The Hive or something.
Yeah. And leaves to become...
A beekeeper, an actual... And every time he kills someone,
Ingenious.
He drops like a bee pun. So you're thinking, oh, well, maybe, you know, that's what they do. But then you meet another beekeeper who's just a normal assassin. No puns. He's just a straight... Jason Statham's just this weird little guy.
It's just the Staith.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Transporter 3 is not as good as Transporter 2.
And Transporter 1's fine.
But Transporter 2 made me laugh an insane amount.
Okay. Is it Crank, though?
None of them are Crank. I'm sorry, Crank is top tier. Jason Statham.
It's top tier steak.
Yeah, it's on the Mount Rushmore of steak movies. Crank is Abraham Lincoln. Is Abraham Lincoln on that? Whoever's on Mount Rushmore.
I don't think it was like a hierarchy. I thought they were all equals in the Rock.
Well, it'll be silly. So Crank is top tier. I think what's the other one that's really good?
I don't know.
Transporters up there.
Right.
I am not the gay. A quality line.
So we've got Crank, we've got
Transporter. There must be others.
I don't know.
I mean, The Untouchables isn't up there. The Untouchables. The Expendables. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
That's not on there.
It's not up there.
But they're good when he's in them. Oh, Hobbs and Shaw. Hobbs and Shaw is fantastic.
Right, okay.
Not so much Fast and the Furious, although I don't think I've seen his Fast and the Furious films. Because I kind of dipped away from them halfway through. But Hobbs and Shaw is brilliant because both The Rock and The Staith know that they have exactly the same thing in their contract. So if The Rock makes a funny, Staith's got to make a funny.
Okay.
If The Rock punches The Staith, The Staith's got to punch The Rock.
Right.
They've got it in the contract. We will have exactly the same amount of punches.
So you're not watching Hobbs and Shaw. You're watching Staith and The Rock. Yeah.
And Statham's brilliant. Statham's better than The Rock.
Right.
Statham's cooler than The Rock.
Well, he is. He also has the self-awareness. Self-awareness goes a long way.
The Staith has got a great deal of self-awareness.
Yeah.
That, let's be honest, what convinced The Rock?
Well, yeah.
Because, you know, the epoch range of the DC Universe hierarchy.
The Fast and the Furious hierarchy is about to change.
So Staith gets extra points for his self-awareness.
He does. Yeah.
So, anyway.
We're no longer doing the Doom Patrol. We're going to be doing retrospective on Jason Statham.
Retrospective on Jason Statham. Oh, the Meg. Top tier, surely.
Right, okay.
It's on the Mount Rushmore.
Isn't it the second one where he teams up with the Meg to take down a bunch of terrorists?
But if it is, that is the best film ever made.
I do believe the Meganin is where he teams up with the Meg to take care of terrorists.
The Meg is brilliant. I love the Meg.
Right.
Oh, God, I love Jason Statham. Anyway, now that we've ranked the Jason Statham movies, we shall continue with Michael's email. My wife loves Tim Burton. So when that abomination of... Oh, so at least he didn't like it. Of a film was out, we went to see it. And regret followed. So it's not like we went in thinking it was going to be great, nor did we ever, at any point during the entire runtime, enjoy ourselves. There you go. That is the best review of Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes you could possibly have. Put that on the film poster.
It's okay if you watch the film as long as you suffer.
No point in the entire runtime did we enjoy ourselves, Michael Bailey and Rachel. If film companies have any balls whatsoever,
yeah,
that would be on the movie poster.
Bad reviews make you want to watch something more.
Well, the recent Madam Web thing.
Oh, yeah.
Every single terrible review just made me want to go, there may be something to this film. And it's got Dakota Johnson in it, who's got a fine line in acerbic humour. If you watched any of her interviews for that film, where she is so deadpan. It's got Shelley What's-Her-Face in it. Sweeney. Right. Sydney Sweeney. Never knowingly unpretty. Not possibly the greatest actor in the world, but no.
She's loads. She's a great actress. And great producer.
Who's Sydney Sweeney?
Yeah.
What she produced?
What was it like years ago before she was in Euphoria? Auditioned for a horror film. The film couldn't get made because of budgeting and finance issues. So for years, she built up enough money so that she could go back and produce that film, and it's coming out simply because she wanted to make it come out.
Fair play. Is that because of Sony money?
Don't know. Or
Euphoria money or whatever.
Probably.
Fair play. No problem.
She also produced the rom-com she's in at the moment as well.
The one with the guy from...
Anyone But You. Yeah. So she produced that as well.
Fair play.
So
she's becoming a Sandy Buttocks. Sorry, a Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
Right. So you're going to produce her own stuff. Because that recent Sandra Bullock film,
right,
where she's a writer, so she's like Jessica Fletcher.
Okay.
Or Castle.
Right.
And they've hired somebody to be the hunk of her books. Think it's Channing Tatum.
Wait, is this not Argyle?
No, this isn't. Argyle is a completely different film about a writer who has hired somebody to be the hunk of her books.
Yeah, right.
That is What's-Her-Face, Bryce Dallas Howard,
yeah,
and the man who can never possibly be replaced as Superman.
Henry Cavill.
That's him.
Yeah, right.
Can't remember his name. That is a different film to this one. But this one's got Daniel Radcliffe in it.
Right, okay.
The guy who now does not care what he does because he's got Harry Potter money.
Yeah.
So he just does stuff that he thinks will be fun.
Yeah.
Surprisingly fun film.
Okay.
Not good.
Yep.
But surprisingly fun film. Anyway, that should explain everything. Well, I hope so. Anyway, love the episode. Take care. Until next time, Mikey might be. I'm very much looking forward to Michael hearing that discussion and writing an email about his email that led to that tangent of what Statham movie would be on the Mount Rushmore of Jason Statham movies.
And I hope he lets us know which Jason Statham films he would put on his Mount Rushmore.
I think everybody should do that. I think that should be the next thing we get trending on X.
That should be like, you know, kind of small talk. It's like, oh, what do you do? Oh, what, you know, what do you come from? So what's your favourite Jason Statham?
What's your favourite Jason Statham?
Oh, mine's the Undestructibles.
Oh, I don't know the weaker threats. Mine's Crank. You and me, mate. It's a terrible film, but it's great at the same time.
Well, none of his films are really the pinnacle of the silver screen, let's be honest.
Sorry, what? I'm sorry, you put him up against Schwarzenegger, who, let's be honest, has a Stopper My Mumble. No, Stopper My Mumble. She was Stallone, isn't it? What's
is
the
it, yeah.
one that Arnie did? Jingle All the Way. He's got a Jingle All the Way in his back catalogue.
That's true.
Stallone's got a Stopper My Mumble Shoot in his back catalogue. There are no turkeys in the States back catalogue. Except maybe the Expendables movies.
Kubrick, Spielberg, Kurosawa, Statham.
Lay a cake. He didn't lay a cake, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Doesn't he do all of those Matthew Vaughn movies?
I think so, yeah.
I think he's in all of them as well. Anyway, enough tittle-tattle where we discuss the state of cinema as it pertains to Jason Statham and his rise through the pantheon of truly great action heroes. Because he is.
Yeah.
No, I'm being serious. I think he's brilliant. I love Jason Statham.
He went right where Stallone and Schwarzenegger went wrong. Yeah. They wanted to be serious.
Yes, they wanted to be serious actors. And they wanted to do stuff that flexed their muscles and actors. And Statham's like, no, I'm just going to punch a shark in the nose. This is brilliant, mate.
Okay.
He's got a bomb under his car.
Right.
In the transporter. I think it's three because we watched two and three back to back.
Okay.
And kind of merge into another. So what he does, right, he launches his car off a ramp.
Right.
He swirls the car over like in James Bond.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He gets the bomb perfectly timed to catch on a hook that is off of a crane.
Okay.
It hooks the bomb off the car.
And then he flips the car back.
He lands. And he just carries on driving as the bomb explodes.
He is that cool. I believe Jason Statham did that stunt himself.
You wouldn't if you saw the CG, quite frankly. Oh, it was the pinnacle of movies. No film will ever better that or has ever bettered.
Rest in peace, Orson Welles. You would have loved Jason Statham.
The Transporter 3. Anyway, today on the show, we are not doing a retrospective of Jason Statham, nor why we think he is the greatest thing to happen to action movie cinema since Chow Yun Fat. We are, in fact,
also another show that I could quite happily do.
Yet. The action movie cinema of Chow Yun-Fat and Jason Statham. And he don't make stupid quicks either.
Yeah.
He doesn't go, you're nailed, when he used the nail gun.
He does. Only does it a bit like, you're nailed, mate.
No, he's very stoic.
He doesn't
with the quips. He knows that's not what you're there to see. You're there to see him kick ass.
And quip.
Well, all right. We're doing the Doom Patrol.
We are doing the Doom Patrol.
This was your pick.
It was my pick.
In addition to the Unstoppable Doom Patrol, a seven issue miniseries. Changes halfway through, doesn't it?
It does.
We are also going to look at their very first appearance from My Greatest Adventure issue 80. This hasn't happened since the Punisher miniseries of the 1980s.
What?
Where it says part one of a four-part series, and then issue two said part two of a five-part series.
Yeah.
And then issue three said part three of a four-part series. And then make your mind up, dudes. What are you going to do? Anyway, this is your bag. Take over.
It is. But yeah, so Doom Patrol, DC's strangest superhero team, are admittedly a bit of an unknown for myself. You know, on paper, there's not really anything about them that I wouldn't really dig, but for whatever reason, they just never really appealed. Something just didn't click. You know, sure, I've tried the odd one, to no one's surprise. Back through college, I read Morrison's run. In uni, Gerard Way relaunched the team with a brand new title, which ushered in a whole new wave of titles under the Young Animals imprint. I read the first issue of which and just never carried on, spending the better part of the last decade saying, I'll grab the trade at some point. And then there was the TV show from Netflix, and I took just one look at it and just thought, yeah, no, I'm all right, thanks.
That was on Netflix.
Yeah, or at least
These
it was
are due
bought
for
out by
trouble.
Netflix.
Because I it, Titans is still on Netflix,
Yeah,
and they appear in
it
Titans.
span off from that.
Yeah,
There's a
but
Doom Patrol episode, yeah.
I have no idea where the Doom Patrol TV show is over here. I'm sure at some point somebody has told me where it is over here,
Right.
but it was like nowhere that I could find it,
Oh,
so I've never watched it.
maybe it's a rights thing then.
Because I've always quite fancied it.
Because not everything that's on HBO Max or Max now is available over here, is it, for
No,
whatever reason?
yeah, there's a lot of things that don't get over here. It'll take forever. I think
Yeah.
Doom Patrol is, but I'd be damned if I know what channel it's on.
Yeah. But yeah, for whatever reason, the team that embodied a perfect marriage between the golden age weirdness and 90s vertigo edginess just didn't click for myself until last year, when there was a 7-issue miniseries that came crawling from the wreckage of a Bat Family summer crossover
I
event.
see what you did there.
Meh. But just who are the Doom Patrol anyway? The Doom Patrol, created by writers Arnold Drake and Bob Haney, along with artist Bruno Premiani, debuted in issue 80 of My Greatest Adventure in June 1963, when it was undergoing a transformation into a superhero adventure anthology title. Apparently, the book was at risk of cancellation, and it was up to Drake to come up with an idea that could save the book. The title followed in the footsteps of other books at the time, such as Marvel's The Fantastic Four, with the team going on strange and daring adventures while also dealing with their own personal soap opera dramas, which, while common for Marvel at the time, was never really done by DC.
Like you, I barely know the Doom Patrol. First came across them in the pages of the new Teen Titans, where they were already dead. It's completely rare that a team in comics be killed off so decisively, but the Doom Patrol were gone. Caput. They were survived by Changeling, now a member of the Teen Titans, and Robot Man. It sounds a little bit like RoboCop. I am a robot, and I'm a man. I am Robot Man.
There's another podcast we could do on theme tunes in which you can say the title.
If you can't sing the title to the theme tune, your theme tune is crap. Robot Man survived the cataclysm that killed the team and ended up, I think, he just bouncing around the DC universe for a little while. But the reason I wasn't aware of the Doom Patrol was they'd been long out of the comics before I started reading. As stated, they were invented purely to keep the title My Greatest Adventure alive. Haney, and who was the other guy that you mentioned? Alfred Drake. Came up with the idea of Dr. Niles Calder, a wheelchair-bound electronics genius, leading a team of superheroes, the size-changing Elastigirl, now Elastiwoman, also known as ex-actress Rita Farr. Robot Man, a former race car driver, Cliff Steele, whose brain has been put in a robotic body following his catastrophic accident. Later, they added the bandaged Negative Man, former pilot Larry Traynor, who would project a strange energy entity, but only for 60 seconds at a time, lest he die. The tagline, "The World's Strangest Heroes," was added, and they were initially so successful as to have the book quickly renamed after them with issue 86.
But popularity didn't last long, as in 1968, issue 121, the book was cancelled and the home team died, quite definitively. But you can't keep a good thing down. The Doom Patrol would return in many forms. First, with a whole new lineup in Showcase, which then span into their own title once again, which lasted 87 issues and three writers, Kupperberg, Morrison, and Pollack, before being cancelled once again in 1995. But then, once again, the team was revived in 2001, that dared to be a fresh start that could find success by ignoring the Vertigo line completely. But once again, after 22 issues, the book was cancelled. John Byrne would then give the book another go in 2004, but made a few Byrne-esque decisions that fans weren't too pleased about, which meant they weren't too arsed when the run suffered the same fate and was cancelled with issue 18. With the last two runs ignoring the events of the Vertigo era, DC made the executive decision to bring it back into the canon as part of their Infinite Crisis event, leading to many fan-favourite characters popping up in other titles from time to time before Keith Giffen got a go at the team in 2009. But wouldn't you know it, it only lasted 22 issues as the sales waned. But not to worry, for the book was cancelled in 2011, it didn't really matter anyway, as the New 52 was just around the corner, and while the team wouldn't find themselves in their own title again, they would still exist as cameos and references in other books, which is better than some treatment that some characters got. In September 2016, Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance fame came and gave a shot at launching a whole new era and a whole new title for the team, which was successful enough to warrant having its own imprint. The book ran for 12 issues and continued in its second volume. But did Gerard Way find the key to Doom Patrol's success? Were miniseries the secret to all along? No. Gerard Way's Doom Patrol was cancelled once again after Volume 2's Issue 7. Well, it's not going too well for the Doom Patrol, is it? You could almost say that they're doomed to be cancelled.
Wow, I was dead impressed by that. That said, the first run was quite successful and lasted 4 years before sales finally caught up to them and the series came to an end with issue 121. This final storyline saw the team confronting frequent enemy Madame Rouge, who teams with the ex-Nazi Captain Zahl to lure the Doom Patrol into a trap, whereby they're forced to choose between the destruction of a tiny New England fishing village or their own deaths. The team proves themselves to be true heroes, defiantly giving their lives to save a dozen people they don't even know, and bringing both the title and the team to an end. One can only speculate how the appearance of the X-Men over at Marvel affected the Doom Patrol, given how close they are to each other in publication. Coincidences do happen in comics, but it's such a tight deadline that it's hard to claim Stan Lee and Jack Kirby ripped off the Doom Patrol, but the similarities are definitely there. When did you say this came out? Because I've just Googled it on Mike's Amazing World of Comics.
Right.
And X-Men came out on July 1963. And you have June this coming 63. Out in June 1963. So there is not enough time there for Marvel to have ripped off the Doom Patrol. But obviously the X-Men went on to become what the X-Men became.
Yeah.
And the Doom Patrol didn't. Still, I only read Doom Patrol haphazardly, the Teen Titans story, some of Grant Morrison's reboot, the god-awful John Byrne series. So when I picked up the facsimile reprint of My Greatest Adventure, issue 80, which is here, lovely listener, I was amazed at how good this was.
Yeah.
I was genuinely impressed with it. Drawn by Bruno Premiani, My Greatest Adventure, issue 80, has two adventures with the Doom Patrol. The origin story, and then a follow-up with General Immortus. That's my synopsis.
It's essentially, I mean, there's not really much else. The first story is just exposition to introduce everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's here, I think, that kind of spotlights the appeal of the Doom Patrol, in that just like the X-Men are well-known for being, they are analogues for outcasts of you know, society at the time, and there's a lot of it that kind of still happens now. You know, no one in sports wants to play against Robot Man because of his apparent physical superiority, and there's all sorts of things here that you understand why they appeal. And also it is funny kind of reading it in hindsight, where I don't know when it was introduced that Niles Calder orchestrated everything.
Grant Morrison's run.
Was it?
I think so, yeah.
But if you read this first one, you can totally buy that he set this all up.
Mm-hmm.
He knows everything about how the bomb is, a brand new bomb that no one's ever seen before. He knows exactly how to deactivate it. He knows the best way to do it. It was fascinating reading this.
It's a retcon with that totally hindsight. Works,
yeah, yeah.
I was genuinely impressed with both these stories. They didn't read like traditional DC strips from the early 60s. They've got a lovely advert here because it's obviously it's a facsimile. I love facsimile editions. Some people don't. They're curmudgeons. It's an easy way to... I would never have bought My Greatest Adventure issue 80.
Yeah.
Not at the price that it currently is. But here, I can buy it for cover price. Well, not 10 cents, obviously. But the cover price nowadays and actually have the issue. It's great. There's a maturity and a depth to this that isn't present. If you have a look at the other adverts, The Flash, World's Finest, Superman and Batman are bison fighting a big robot. Sugar and Spike, I don't even know what that is. And Mystery in Space looks interesting.
Yeah, it's Adam Strange.
Yeah, because that looks a bit Flash Gordon. But the actual stories and the character, there's a lot more going on here than an average DC comics of the time. It felt like a Marvel comic.
Yeah.
Of the era. More effort was being put into the characterization here than in standard DC comics. And it felt, actually to me, more mature than Marvel comics of the time. Because they've not got Stan's overblown dialogue.
No, it's there in the soap operas there, but it's, you know, it's handled in its own way. Like, it still very much feels like the time. There's a lot of exposition.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the soap operas dealt with a lot of maturity. Like, what if Coronation Street was on HBO, I guess?
Yeah, there's very definitely that feeling that the Marvel characters, but they're in a DC book. So it's the bickering and the infighting is there from Marvel, but so are the self-effacing gags and self-loathing.
Yeah.
And the feeling that not everything is fine. Like, The Flash gets his powers and Barry Allen goes, I must help mankind, puts on his suit and tickety-boo. Yeah. His powers are a boon.
Yeah.
Whereas over at Marvel, Bruce Banner hates being the Hulk. Ben Grimm hates being the Thing.
Yeah.
And you get the same feeling from the Doom Patrol. If every one of these could get rid of their powers and go back to a normal life, they would.
They would.
I mean, the only one I had a problem with was Rita. It's like, when she's at normal size, why couldn't she carry on her acting career? Is there a reason? Do they explain that at some point?
I don't know.
Because it seems to me that once she learns to control it, that there was nothing stopping her just carrying on with her career.
Yeah.
And she'll save an awful lot in special effects budgets.
True.
If she turns Attack of the 50-Foot Woman into a franchise, she's laughing, isn't she? Again, facsimile reprint. I love these, especially the 60s and 70s ones I weren't around for. Not as big of a fan as the facsimiles for ones I bought originally, because that just makes you feel old. What did you think?
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It was a pleasant surprise.
The art's great as well. Yeah. I like it's weird because I kind of feel like with a lot of art from this era, even the great artists are still kind of, they look 60s. Whereas this, if you cleaned up the colouring on this, it holds up as a modern comic, yeah. I think.
The splash page, The Challenge of the Timeless Commander, generally Mortis piece of art, that's really good.
Yeah.
I love all the 60s dials and toggle switches as well. But yeah, you're right. If you cleaned this up a bit, like the inking's very heavy on page 7.
Yeah.
Maybe lighten that up a bit, I don't know. But one of the things I love about DC's facsimiles is they publish them on newsprint.
Yeah.
Marvel don't.
All right.
Marvel published them on glossy paper. So it doesn't feel as authentic as this. This feels like Enfield Gang Massacre, doesn't it?
Yeah. You've just bought it off the newsstand.
Yeah. And what I love about this one as well, there is nothing on the cover, though, to say this is a facsimile edition. There's not even a modern-day price on it.
Oh, like a barcode or anything like that. Yeah,
nothing. Whereas, again, Marvel's have barcode, and I think DC's do now. So if you slabbed that, we could sell that for 400 quid, man. And no one would ever know, because that's on the back.
Yeah.
And as you well know, that if you slab it and take it out to look at the back, well, you've ruined it, haven't you?
You have.
So
it's gone down a grade.
So 400 quid. There you go.
It is interesting why the Doom Patrol never really took off, even especially now, because considering how, you know, similar they are to the X-Men, obviously they are a representation and work well as commentaries for, you know, sexuality and gender identity and all that kind of thing and disabilities. And I think what the Doom Patrol have over the X-Men is, I know they've kind of changed it in the last 20 years or so, is every single member of the X-Men is attractive. They're good looking. Whereas the Doom Patrol, you know, they represent that kind of warts and all aspects. You know, they're not, one's a robot, one's wrapped in bandages. They are these physical outcasts. And I think there's like an edginess there that I'm surprised that they never became as big as the X-Men.
And there's also, and we'll get into it as we go along, though, in these 7 issues, though, that All of that is true, what you just said. Yet there's more humanity in them than has ever really been displayed by the X-Men. Wolverine just wants to gut everybody. Whereas every single one of these characters are about giving people a second chance.
Yeah. And we'll get to this later on, but that's... So this new series started as a story completely unrelated to the Doom Patrol in an event called the Lazarus Planet, in which a volcano on Lazarus Island erupts and gives superpowers to previously normal people. I'd love to go into more detail about it, but I haven't read it and I have no interest in doing it.
Me neither, but I will give writer Dennis Culver all the credit in the world. I didn't feel I needed to read it.
Me neither. These 7 issues, originally 6, do just a great job of just throwing you into the deep end,
but also giving you enough information to understand what's happening.
So released in March 2023, The Unstoppable Doom Patrol was written by Dennis Culver with art by Chris Burnham and David LaFuente with colours and letters by Brian Reber and Pat Brosso respectively, and features a brand new lineup with a brand new mission. Led by Kay Challis, aka Crazy Jane, under her new personality of the Chief, the team consists of Elastowoman, Negative Man, Robot Man, and newcomers Beast Girl and Degenerate. In the wake of the Lazarus event, more and more metagenes are activating in humans. Some don't know where to go after being shunned, and others are collected by companies such as Metagen and experimented on. The Doom Patrol are here to find these individuals and give them a new home and a new purpose, all the while being hounded by the US military and Peacemaker.
Peacemaker's a prick in this.
But even on the inside, there are problems. The Chief persona is struggling to keep in control, with Jane just beneath the surface trying to get out, made all the more difficult by Niles Calder's constant nagging to be given back his former position. In fact, most of the team are struggling, especially Degenerate, who was experimented on by Metagen, and Elastowoman, who doesn't believe that she deserves her newfound happiness. One of the team members is even a spy who infiltrated under the orders of Peacemaker, but stays overlooked due to being a literal worm.
Quite like Timber.
Behind the scenes, General Immortus is creating an army out of a wide array of worldwide villains, even manipulating Mala to betray long-term partner The Brain. Some are recruited willingly, others against their will.
Sorry, you can't read that enough. It's Mala and The Brain. Mala and The Brain.
One is a genius.
It's insane.
It's on a day like any other when he launches his attack, with the Brotherhood of Evil teleporting straight into Doom Patrol HQ and interrupting a training exercise. The most dangerous villain is the Quiz, who has control over every single power there is until that power is said out loud. The team struggle to fend off the constant onslaught, especially the rookies, but the attack is only a distraction from Immortus's real goal. The Graveminders, a small team within the Doom Patrol led by Willoughby Kipling, teleports Niles and Robot Man to the grave of Dorothy Spinner, a former member of the team and a friend to Cliff, that's been desecrated by Immortus and Hoongan. The team arrive too late, however, and Immortus melts before them once the ritual has been completed. But this is not the end for Immortus, as this was his goal all along, to be reborn as the Candlemaker, the psychic manifestation of the world's nuclear anxieties made real by Dorothy a long time ago. Immortus, now the Eternal Flame, is just simply too strong for the Doom Patrol. Still struggling with the Brotherhood of Evil, the Chief and Negative Man restrain Quiz long enough for the Chief to pull her subconsciousness into her own, where Crazy Jane is allowed to finally regain control long enough to talk to the Quiz. The Quiz, once called Sachiko, was once a member of the Brotherhood of Dada, who, years ago, used the painting that ate Paris to fight the Doom Patrol, but she was trapped inside, and she's lived there ever since. The perfect painted world quickly became the perfect home for her, until Immortus pulled her out and held the last scrap of the painting hostage to force her into fighting for him. But Jane promises that if Sachiko helps them defeat Immortus, then she'll have a new home with the Doom Patrol. They teleport to Dorothy's grave to find the Candlemaker has defeated the Doom Patrol's skeleton crew and also burns the scrap of painting once he sees the Quiz's betrayal. Angered, she manipulates his control over his powers and renders him completely powerless before dropping him into the rift between the worlds, called the Bleed. The fights didn't go unnoticed, though, and the worn-out members of the team spot Peacemaker approaching on the horizon. Tired, broken, and beaten, the team have nothing left in them to fight, but Degenerate stays behind to buy them enough time to escape through a portal back to the base. After all, they freed him once, they can do it again. To some, this doesn't feel like a win, but sometimes you have to take what you can get. But one thing is for certain, the Doom Patrol will return.
Yay! Good synopsis.
Well, it's kind of funny as well, because I wrote synopsis for every issue and I was like, this doesn't work well, because the format of it is it's very much like a TV show. Every issue is its own story or its own episode with things happening in the background. Essentially, the story is the last two or three issues.
Yeah, but the first four build up to that.
And it's great. I'd have been more than happy for them to keep doing this. Every issue starts with you thrown in the deep end and playing catch up. It's fun. But like you mentioned earlier, there's so many quiet moments of characterization that just really works.
Yeah, I was really impressed with this. Mm. I've got to be honest, this was a good pick. As somebody who wasn't that big a fan, I didn't really know anything about him, other than what I've already mentioned. So the fact that you were able to get thrown into this first issue, follow everything, have a basic understanding of who everyone was and what the mission of the team is, which is we're just going to offer a helping hand.
Yeah.
We're not here to judge. We're not here to beat people up.
Yeah.
We're not here to arrest people. We're just here to help them. And there's the little moments of characterization, like Rita reading an issue of Fangoria on the bus.
Yeah.
I don't know why that amused me so much, but it did. I liked the double page splash introducing the team, just stood there. I loved all that. That underneath each person, it's the name and the civilian name.
Yeah.
So then you don't have to have exposition. Like at the moment, Secret Wars is being reprinted in facsimile editions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there is literally a moment where the story stops dead, though, while the characters literally say, and I'm Captain America, and I'm Wolverine, and I'm the Easter Bunny. And you're like, no, you're the Thing. And now there's an entire range of people who don't know who you are who think you're the Easter Bunny. And it's just dreadful.
Yeah.
Whereas this is so much better than that. It's handled really well. One of the things about having the original issues as well is we can talk about stuff we haven't talked about for ages, like the ads. What the hell was Gotham Knights?
Oh, I've no idea. Did that not? Oh no, I think I do know what that is, and I think it was cancelled before it even really started.
Well, I presume with the title Gotham Knights, it's something to do with Batman, right?
It's Batman's dead.
Of course he is.
These guys, one of them is not Robin, and one of them's
that's his name, not Robin,
not Cassandra Cain or whatever.
Right.
But I think that's the same plot for the Arkham Knights video game, and right. I think there was a lot, yeah.
Right, okay, because looking at that poster, it does not make me want to watch it.
No.
Does it? A bunch of five emo-looking people staring at you.
Is one of them
emo.
Not What's-His-Face Skarsgård, or does he just look a bit like him?
I have no idea, it doesn't say who the actors are.
No, it doesn't.
And none of them look familiar to me, so I presume it got cancelled in short order. The first issue takes place in Gotham City. Cliff hates Gotham City.
I love the first few pages where they're just stuck in all the bustling crowds and they're all just watching them after they've parked awfully.
Yeah, the art is brilliant. I like Chris Burnham a lot. He's like a good Frank Quitely.
Please.
I maintain Frank Quitely. You strip the colouring away from Frank Quitely stuff.
Right.
And you've not got a lot though.
I disagree. Okay. Frank Quitely. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is a bold statement and I might have to back it up. Frank Quitely is, if Leonardo da Vinci was alive today, he would be drawing comics. Frank Quitely. Have you ever...
What, like one every issue 7 years?
Have you ever seen da Vinci's pencil drawings?
No. Oh yeah, I've seen him for his helicopter. Yes.
Right.
He came up with the helicopter, didn't he?
Yeah. His pencil drawings and his caricatures look just like Frank Quitely drawings. You just went past it as well. The bit that's Audrey Horne in Twin Peaks.
It is, yeah. Even with only with one eye.
Even with one eye. The outfit, the hair, that's Audrey Horne.
Yeah. Batman shows up for a sales boost.
Well, you need it. It's the first issue.
It's the first issue of a Doom Patrol comic.
Yeah.
And they weren't expecting this to sell.
Probably. I did enjoy, there's a lot of anti-superhero arguments to be made. This is the one that I felt worked. Batman's trying to argue that, you know, put them in Arkham Asylum, da 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 da.
Yeah.
The Doom Patrol are arguing, well, no, because that's not going to help them. Why don't you just let us take over? And even Tim's like, yeah, no, they've got a point. Come on.
Yeah. Where they're arguing that no good has ever come out of Arkham.
Yeah.
They don't cure them. They end up just escaping and causing more hassle. And yeah, I love that Robin's like, they've got a point to be fair.
Yeah.
Which Robin is this?
I think it's Tim.
Is it Tim Drake? Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. So, and like you say, this works as like a pilot for a TV show.
Yeah, and rescuing Degenerate.
Yeah, Degenerate's really quite cool.
Who has to be a scumbag to get his powers.
Yeah.
I love Beast Girl. She's a lot of fun.
The little one who wants to be an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun. The whole team just clicks. There's a lot of characterization going on here, a lot of banter, and it just all works.
Yeah, it was a really good first issue. And then it ends with Peacemaker, who I think is just a massive tit.
See, I have no knowledge of them. The only knowledge I have of Peacemaker stems from that one issue of Multiversity where he exists to be killed off.
Right.
So I know James Gunn brought him into Guardians, and I know he had his own TV show. And
Suicide Squad.
That's it.
Into Guardians would have been entered.
Suicide Squad, and then he had his own TV show, and I think this stems more so from that. But I know nothing of Peacemaker.
He's very much the guy who thinks that the end justifies the means.
Right.
And you follow the letter of the law.
Right, okay.
Even if that is clearly wrong and clearly going to cause some damage.
Yeah.
He's that kind of person, which culminates in a big fight between him and Colonel Flagg at the end of the Suicide Squad. The Suicide Squad's quite good.
Okay.
I ended up watching that last week with him on.
He's the guy who thinks that, no, Starship Troopers is serious.
Yes. Yeah, he probably takes that at face value. So, issue one's great. Yeah, good setup, nice characters, all well introduced by the writer, lovely art. Very, very good first issue. Very impressive. I didn't really expect that much from it.
No, it's fun as well. And then we get to the second issue, which kind of slows it down. It's more of a character analysis. This one's not so fun, and then it ends up with a child being blown up.
I loved this issue.
Yeah, no, but it's a different type of story than what we'd get in the rest of the series.
It's basically, the idea is that the Peacemaker has infiltrated the Doom Patrol with this new member of the team, Worm, and her little sidekick, which is the furry blue thing.
Yeah.
And she's actually there to inform on the Doom Patrol because Peacemaker clearly doesn't like what Doom Patrol are doing because, God forbid, you should be compassionate.
Yeah.
Which goes against the grain in so many ways. And at the end of it, he uses that thing that Task Force X have in the back of their head to blow up a child.
And it turns out that Doom Patrol knew all along. Yeah. If they'd just been honest, they could have sort of saved them.
And they were giving her the chance to come clean.
And then
Velvet is actually the thing that's infiltrating the team.
Yeah. But being an actual worm, then no one's going to suspect it, yeah.
They just think that they'll look after it. On the one hand, it is quite a dark story that it does culminate with Peacemaker blowing up a child. But there is so much fun in it. Like the shelter, which is a head case. You know, you've got to love a cross-section.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We haven't had one of them in ages, a cross-section on the headquarters. And I love that the octopus just lounging in the swimming pool.
It's kind of this. And this series, I think, embraces the kind of golden age aspect of it, like having a big cross-section here.
Yeah. And having the Beast Girl looking out of a panel.
Yeah.
The cross section.
Yeah.
I thought was quite cute. I love Cliff's line about giant robots come after metahumans now. So was that a nod to the Sentinels?
Maybe, yeah.
In the X-Men. There's an entire subplot here about the Chief making a play for the Doom Patrol leadership that feels like it was going to go somewhere and kind of sort of is resolved by issue 6 and 7.
Yeah.
But did feel like it was going to go somewhere else.
Mm.
What it did.
Nice little callback here to the Vertigo era. Mm-hmm. You know, you see the lineup of the Morrison Pollack era, which I think was nice. And I think this is very much a sequel to that era of the Doom Patrol.
Feels like they've very much landed in the Vertigo arena to the point where I was quite surprised this wasn't a Black Label, but it isn't anyway. But also this bit where he visits Dorothy Spinner's grave. On the one hand, it's just a small little character bit, and I didn't have a clue who she was.
Right.
But it plays out in issue six.
Yeah.
It's there for a reason.
And it's not only that it pays off as well, but I think it's kind of a nice way of showing the history that the Doom Patrol have had as well, and gives character to Cliff. You know, his big thing is he's essentially the robot with a heart.
Yeah. Well, a brain, anyway. Peacekeeper essentially manipulates a child in this.
Yeah, yeah.
So surely that's some kind of abuse.
Ends justify the means.
Yeah, I love the bit where the little worm thing, was it Velvet, creeps around and sees what everybody's up to in their own quarters.
Nice little bits here that, you know, Flex and Rita are together now. I don't know what's going on with her. She's a bit clay facey, and I think that might lead into what you were saying about what's the problem with her shrinking. And see, I think what I get in this, because there's the odd panel where like her face has sunk.
Yeah.
Like
she keeps on a handsome face when she's around everybody else.
Yeah.
But she drops it. But this is what we talked about over text, about how it felt like an ongoing.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, he would like it to be an ongoing.
Yeah.
And just see what happens if you go from there.
We see Cliff's talking out to Danny the Street, which, as we see from the end, might pay off later on.
Yeah.
We see the Justice League Doom Patrol Dark guys hanging out, which, you know, also pays off again.
Later on, Crazy Jane's having conversations with other different personalities. I like Beast Girl just sat playing on the PlayStation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all she's doing. There's no angst, though. That's what I like about it. Like, the others are all a little bit angsty, or there's something going on.
Yeah.
She's very face value.
Yeah.
I'm a kid. I'm playing the PlayStation.
Do you think that's kind of like a reflection of Beast Boy? Like, they can't have Beast Boy, so they'll have Beast Girl.
Yeah, possibly. But again, I liked it. I like that she's got no facade.
It just is what it is.
She is what she is, yeah. Think Tank 2 is introduced here. That gets paid off a little bit more later on. And I did like the ending where Doom Patrol knew the traitor and wanted to give them a chance to come clean. I love that, because the entire theme, or one of the themes of this entire series, was second chances.
Yeah.
And reaching out to people and giving them an option to not perhaps be what they've been before.
Yeah.
And perhaps change, because they've all been given a second chance.
Mm.
Some of them at life.
Yeah.
Because some of them have been dead. And I generally thought that second issue is where it really grabbed me. I enjoyed the first issue, and I thought, this is a good pilot.
Yeah.
It's a good setup.
Yeah.
The second issue was the one where I really thought, no, this is something quite interesting.
When the characters grab you then.
Yeah. I thought that was really quite good. So that second issue may be my favourite. Until we come to the third one.
The third one is my favourite. This one is, it throws you straight into it.
Yeah. The Green Lantern issue.
Cliff and Larry escaping from the Green Lantern in a Mustang with Storms.
Ford Torino.
Is it a Torino? Right, okay.
Well, they can't put Ford on the front.
Yeah, that looks like a Torino.
But that's because it's got that arc.
Yeah.
That curvature in the back that, if you remember Starsky and Hutch, the white stripe came down around that arc and then came into a point above that.
Right, yeah.
So I think it's a Torino.
And it doesn't stop once. That car stays in motion.
Yep.
But despite that, Kyle and Guy are great together.
Yeah, but Guy Gardner's an ass.
Guy Gardner is an ass.
Yeah, he's supposed to be, yeah.
And not only that, but the entire conversation with Cliff, Larry and Starbro is just perfect.
Yeah.
In so many panels and in so many words, you've got that great bit where it's just like, that's a dumb name. No, you call him what they want to be called. Like, I used to ask you to call me, what is it, Nebulous or something. It's like, well, you know, you never corrected me. Like, no, I corrected you every time I told you this was what my name is. And Cliff just has this moment where he's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, it's just...
Yeah, he apologized. He's not a dick about
it. It's great work. And again, it's still, you know, this isn't just superheroes. It's not just superhero code names. You know, it very much holds up today when people have more freedom to choose who they want to be. And it works here as a commentary with superheroes. Yep. Perfect stuff.
Yeah. Well, was there a subtext to this entire issue?
Yeah.
In that Starbro wasn't comfortable in their own skin until they merged with Starro.
Yeah.
And then combined with their own metagene, they essentially become a different person through this transformation.
Yeah.
And through that transformation, they become more at ease with themselves.
Yeah.
And this is only brought about through the transformation of body.
Mm.
Read into that what you will. But they don't bang you over the head with it.
No.
And it's very much subtext.
And it's so, like, I you know, beating a broken record here, but it's so well handled. Mm. Despite the fact that this car literally never stops moving, it does not sacrifice your character moments.
No, no, it's a great Vanishing Point style chase movie.
Yeah.
In one issue. It reminded me of that issue of Hawkeye that was just the VW, the Minis versus the Chargers.
Okay, yeah.
They were basically ripping off the Italian job.
Yeah.
This felt a little bit like that. They're constantly being chased. It's very Terminator. Mm. And all of the conversations take place in the car.
Yeah.
And all of the exposition is delivered in the car. And that all worked exceptionally well because of Cliff's history as a race car driver.
Yeah.
So you could buy that he could do all of this. And I genuinely did laugh out loud. It's very rare a comic makes you laugh out loud.
Right.
But I love the moment where his car has got ghost mode.
He turns it to a ghost.
And it literally drives through an office. Those poor people that he drives through, clearly in therapy.
Well, it's got the great bit as well where it's just like, why are we driving through Smallville? It's like, well, it's the home of Superman. They wouldn't dare come here. And then Guy Gardner literally drops the Smallville.
Trashes the Smallville. Welcome to Smallville, sir. Guy Gardner doesn't come out of this particularly well. Still a little bit better.
But it's the big-headedness that I think kind of works to offset
that arrogance.
Yeah. And it's going back to what I was saying, mentioned earlier, like, that flashback had a little bit of lip service to the history that the Doom Patrol have.
Mm.
There's a lot of this here that only works because of that history as well. You know, when discussing choosing your own name and identity, and Larry's talking about all of his evolutions, you know, you wouldn't get that if it wasn't for 40, 50, what, how many, you know, 60 years worth of history.
And the characters that are having these conversations, very well chosen.
Yeah.
To be doing this particular assignment. So,
again, it's a testament to the writing that you, 3 issues in, you kind of know who these people are, even if you are unaware of decades worth of characterization.
Yeah. And I love the end of the story is, right, you can drive now. Because the story's over. I also liked that this was very much a side quest where the real Doom Patrol adventure was happening somewhere else. I think we only see it on one page, don't we?
And then it's brought up again in the next issue. But yeah, with Animal, Vegetable, Mineral Man.
That was it. Animal, Vegetable, Mineral Man, which is a very silly name, but it is to, you know, if that's what they want to be called. But yeah, and you see it on one page. And it felt very much like that Buffy episode where it's actually following Xander, where Buffy's stopping the end of the world again.
Okay.
And you don't see any of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you say, the Animal, Vegetable, Mineral Man, it's a throwaway gag in this. There you go, that one page.
Yeah.
That on issue 6 and 7, which is a two-parter, pairs off again.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's not the best comparison, but kind of like if you're watching The Sopranos.
Mm.
The Sopranos does not follow every single day of their life, but it picks up on little bits here and there as part of this tapestry. And that's what I think this is as well. Mm. You don't have to see everything. They're just on adventures.
Well, that's what I wondered about this now that you've mentioned it. And I wonder that about if The Sopranos made today, people now are so, you've not shown us that. Whereas there's entire weeks missing in between episodes of Sopranos.
Well, it's
like, and you're just expecting to catch up.
Yeah.
And it's like people aren't, some readers now aren't capable of doing that.
Yeah.
If they don't see it, it didn't happen.
Well, before, you know, you have so many TV shows and cartoons and that. What about the Star Wars when Obi-Wan and Anakin are just having adventures in between films?
Yeah. And I love that in Attack of the Clones, we mentioned this before, Dexter just comes out of nowhere. Everyone's never mentioned Dexter Jester before. And suddenly the best mate.
Here he is, some ex-bounty hunter
he's
now.
Never mentioned
in
again.
In charge of a 50s diner.
Oh, like, this stuff. Where did those two become best mates?
Dexter Jet is George Lucas's greatest contribution to movies.
Well, I love that scene as well, because it is very much, so when did this happen?
Yeah.
And it's just though. It's just, it happened. Deal with it.
Yeah.
But somebody must have written a novel about that, about all those two being best
definitely,
mates.
Definitely, yeah.
And it, me and you came with the backstory at once, didn't we?
I don't know.
Didn't we establish that when Obi-Wan is quintessential work man, when he's at work,
yeah,
he's, you know, he's very straight,
oh, he works
straight-laced,
hard.
And he works hard and does his job.
And then he parties
But then he goes
hard.
Home, and the Death Sticks bit as well. You know, because when they walk in there, he goes, I'm getting a drink. And you're like, knows his way around a bar, Obi-Wan. Yeah. So my thinking is, weekends, him and Dexter.
Obi-Wan wedding crashing.
I'm just out doing, having wedding crashes. He's just having a good laugh. Yeah. And then he comes back, and then he's back to being here. You can't go against the council master. You were a bender all weekend, Obi-Wan. Don't you be lecturing me. Oh, if this kid hadn't showed up, you and Padme, but you know. Anyway, issue four. Issue four is a weird one, isn't it?
It's the add-in. So when it was originally six issues, I think, I'm not sure what the real reason is, but I think it's Chris Burnham.
It was added due to Night Terrors.
Was that what it was?
Yeah,
right,
okay. After we had that text conversation, right. I thought, all right, let's look this up. And I found an interview with Dennis Culver,
yeah,
where he said they asked him, did he mind doing a Night Terrors issue? But he was like, he didn't want to interrupt the flow of his story.
Right.
So he looked at how we'd structured his story and he was like, all right, well, where can I put in an issue that isn't necessarily a crossover,
yeah,
but feels like it could be part of that.
Right.
And in doing so, if I slap it here, I don't interrupt the narrative too much,
yeah,
but I give Chris a bit of a buffer.
Yeah. Because it works as well, because I think after this, it's more or less non-stop until the finale. But
yes,
this kind of allows the characters to breathe a bit.
Well, have you ever read that X Factor issue where Peter David does this?
No.
It's an entire issue of Doc Samson just psychoanalyzing the team.
Right.
And talking to them and getting to them.
Didn't they redo that again in some of the Red Hulk stuff?
Yes, I think so. But this felt very much a homage to that. What made this work for me, what made this is the art.
Yeah,
I love that every time he's actually talking to somebody, it's double page spreads.
And it's essentially an origin story and an exposition and a glimpse into what might come ahead as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly like the Next Factor issue.
There's a slight critique that I would have where it feels like this issue drops seeds for some things that don't pay off and might not pay off unless we get a volume two.
Or an ongoing.
Because I think there's some really interesting bits like this. There's a really good bit where you feel like the therapist, Jerry, is working against the team. She plants the seed in Rita's head that she's not worthy of happiness. Mm-hmm. And she can only have success if she is not happy. And there's this look on her face where she's terrified. And it's a scary thought, you know. What if she can't be as good as she should because she's content? What if she needs misery to push herself?
Yeah.
And there's just a few little character bits like that that I'm really excited to see hopefully get followed up in the next volume.
Yeah, I like that bit where Beast Girl, her dad just completely dismisses her.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because she's the most likable one. Jane won't go.
No.
For obvious reasons. And the last panel's really good. But then the back of it is a Night Terrors plug.
Did you read any of Night Terrors?
No.
Because I didn't either.
I have no idea what Night Terrors was or what it... I mean, look at that chat list. Do you think I'm going to read that?
Yeah.
What is the... There's 23.
Well, I don't think... I think it was one
issues.
I think it was one of those where it kind of like had bookend,
yeah,
set up and ending.
Well, then, First Blood 1, I presume.
But then I think the rest of it, for the most part, was just... issues in
but also
books.
And then Night Terrors 1.
Oh, right, okay.
And Night Terrors 2. But
yeah,
isn't it the weeks that this was going on? That's just month 1.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
Isn't this the month they cancelled their regular books?
Everything did it, yeah.
And it like it killed. I was currently like at that point, I think I remember I was giving the Superman books a try again and Titans and Nightwing.
Yeah.
And this just killed it. Because for 2 months or 3 months, however long this piece
it was
of shit crossover
asked about,
I didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And I just stopped. I didn't order any of them.
Yeah.
And then I didn't pick up with the books that I was reading. So essentially, this lost them a reader.
Yeah.
Right. And we've said this before. I would love to know when Tom Brewer bangs on his subset, will crossovers bring in people? Crossovers buy more books?
Yeah.
I would love to know what the converse of that is. How many of me are there who didn't buy this and then didn't go back to the books they were buying?
Is it not because of how it was handled as well? It wasn't alongside the monthly issues, it was instead of.
And I'm like, I'm not paying money for that, I don't care. And the fact that we don't even remember it now, and this isn't that long ago.
No, it's only last year.
It's like, Blue Beetle gets an advert here. Not seen it.
In fact, it's not even last year. I think it came out for Halloween, so it's not even a year ago. Yeah.
There are so many adverts in this for the Flash film. It's almost like somebody somewhere had said that it was the greatest superhero movie ever made, and that this person is now in charge of DC movies. And that one statement has suddenly made me suspect him.
Mm.
Whereas previously I quite liked him and trusted him to say some measure of the truth.
Yeah.
Not so much now. My Adventures with Superman is on Channel 4.
It is, yeah.
And I've watched the first four. I quite like it.
It's fun, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
I've watched the first four episodes. It's on 4 on demand.
Yeah.
If you want to watch it.
Yeah, no.
Superman and Lois is on BBC iPlayer. But yeah, that was an interlude of sorts, but it didn't suck. Issue 5, again, is an advert for Blue Beetle, which I've not seen. I'm sure it's wonderful.
I forgot Blue Beetle had come out.
Well, I think everybody's thought that Blue Beetle came out, to be fair, along with Aquaman 2.
Oh, has that finally come out as well?
Oh, it came out ages ago and has already gone.
Oh, right, okay.
Number 5, as with issue 3, the team is split into two. So this is another one of those issues that starts and doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Burnham comes back. The colour on this, I think we should throw out to the colourist as well. Is that Brian Rebar?
Mm.
Yeah, Brian Rebar. The colouring on it is brilliant. I think it really adds so much. I like as well the paper stock in this.
Yeah.
We make a big deal of paper stock on this show. But this is, it's not newsprint, but it's not that glossy stuff.
Well, it makes all the difference. It's literally what it's printed on. It's what you're feeling when you're reading it.
You're not angling it, because if it's on glossy stuff, you can't. If the light hits it, you can't see it.
Yeah.
Whereas you've not got that here. You've just got great stuff.
All the MetaGen stuff here I think is great, especially there's a lot at the moment on big companies and social media and AI and that kind of stuff that's all parodied to a degree here. And it not only is it a parody, but it pays off as well. Niles Calder has this moment where
he has to
step down. He realized that, you know, he was the bad guy. He orchestrated terrible things to happen to people for his gains. So it's all really well paying off here. Bit, you know, sad for Metal Woman
who
ends up going a bit Tetsuo.
Yeah, that's all a bit the boys, isn't it? That she's been manipulated by this company to think she's doing good things, and then in fact she ends up dead at the end of it. And that's quite gross in a cool horror movie way.
I do love that the Doom Patrol, they essentially show up, they do what they need to do, and then they bugger off. Most issues end with them going, yeah, we're out of here.
Yeah, we're done. Our work here is done. Yeah, very similar to that Fantastic Four recently, where another head of another big tech company created that app that was monitoring everything.
Yeah.
So next, the Stoppable Doom Patrol. So I like that. That's a good. It's essentially, this is set up for the two-part finale. It's well structured. He's bringing in a lot of stuff here from the Vertigo run.
Yeah, it's essentially a sequel to Morrison, Pollack, that area.
But again, having not read that, I wasn't lost.
Yeah.
I thought he did an excellent job.
That bit's gross where the glove explodes and hands are popping out of hands, popping out of hands.
Yeah, you feel a bit sorry for her, really. Yeah, and it's an important issue for Niles Calder.
Yeah.
Well, an important self-aware moment where he realises I'm the bad guy.
There's so many interesting aspects to this. Like I said before, I really hope there is a second volume, because there's so many loose threads.
Yeah, that's the only complaint I had. It felt like he was writing an ongoing.
Yeah.
And he's not been allowed to do it as an ongoing. So he's focused on the bits he wants to focus on, but he's left enough open.
Yeah. Which might work for the best, you know, considering the Doom Patrol's track record, it might have been cancelled were it an ongoing.
Whereas this way, at least you've got a volume of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose so. Issue 6, I thought the opening was apt. That they're inspired, the X-Men, the series that inspired the X-Men, or the other way around, whatever. Here, they've got an X-Mansion.
Yeah.
They've got a training session that feels like a danger room.
Yeah.
And this constant evolution of the team, the adding of new members, feels very New Mutants.
Mm.
But it actually feels quite fresh here and different for some reason. I don't know why it would feel different. But it does. I did like that NAS Corps wheelchair has machine guns on him.
You know what? Who knows when you're going to have to defend yourself?
That's very true. I like the design of the quiz.
The quiz, I thought, was so kind of golden age stupid but worked that she has control over every single superpower unless you name that superpower. So they just spend the entire fight
just naming superpowers.
But there's the great bit as well where it's like yellow lightning, pink lightning, blue lightning.
Super anxiety. what about imposter syndrome? Ooh, well done. That was all great.
And then Psycho Simon, who was a throwaway line in a previous issue, gets killed off.
She's a shit. I like, who's the John Constantine guy?
What's his face, Kipling? I don't know who he is. Right. But you don't really need to. He's John Constantine, but
that's the thing. There was a point though where I wasn't lost with him because it was like, all right, so he's a John Constantine type, right down to the British accent. Right. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. I don't need to know much more about him. I'm intrigued by the fact that he's no skin on one arm.
Yeah.
So he's just got a skeletal arm, but you know. Whatever, it is what it is. He shows up to do a job.
Yeah.
You've got a brief idea of who he is and it works from there.
This whole ending, I think, is really cool. I don't know what it is. Like, I barely remember the Morrison stuff, but the Candle Maker is just a really cool, interesting design, and seeing Immortus just melt.
Yes.
It's very, you know, really... Again,
quite horror movie-y.
Yeah.
That's RoboCop, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where the guy gets hit by the car and yeah. bursts to pieces.
This feels like it's right at home, both being a superhero title and being a Vertigo title at the same time.
And the Eternal Flame. And I just heard the Bangles. If this was a TV episode...
Is this burning an Eternal Flame?
The Eternal Flame closed this. And this ends with a prelude, advert, tease, whatever you want to call it, of Godzilla versus Kong versus the Justice League.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you are going to thoroughly enjoy.
It's piling up on my to read.
How many issues is it?
Eight. I think I've got four or five of them at the moment.
Okay. Well, if it's any good, we may cover it. Issue 7 is the climax. Each member brings all they've learned over the course of the series. And Dennis Culver closes it off really, really well. Refers to past events for the team. He essentially does tie it all into one big narrative. There's that Grant Morrison approach, it all happened.
Yeah.
However you want to do it.
The Paint of the Eight Paris stuff was just really great. I think we mentioned it, the Guy Gardner stuff, he was like, oh yeah, there's that. But it's just really nice kind of seeing that comeback, the kind of little bit silly moment, but we're going to take it seriously.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? The Underground makes an appearance. Apparently that was something.
Right.
I don't know what.
Oh, it's where she keeps all of her subconsciouses, isn't it? They show up and that's where they have this conversation.
Yeah. So the Painting That Ain't Paris, you've already mentioned that. It was done in such a way that non-Doom Patrol aficionados like myself weren't lost.
Mm.
And it was genuinely, for the most part, full of wit and invention and rewarding, I presume, for old Doom Patrol readers.
Yeah.
I've not read that any of them hated it. and new readers as well, like us. Chris Burnham was on the top of his game art-wise. The colouring was great. Overall, it was mostly a great miniseries, other than tying it into Batman at the end.
See, this is, I think, where it lost me a little bit as well. There was a very big period of time around metal and death metal where the Batman Who Laughs...
Mm.
Who must have been one of the greatest concepts to come up with from a financial point of view. Because he was everywhere. And now we end this with the Batwoman Who Laughs. Yeah. So there's a part of me that's very reluctant, but judging from these 7 issues...
You're willing to go with it.
We'll see where it goes, yeah. But, you know, Danny the Street makes an appearance.
Yeah.
The Bleed as well. It's been a while since we've seen The Bleed in anything.
Mm-hmm. So he knows... how to bring all his stuff in.
And the fact that essentially this, I don't even think it was a sleeper hit. I think it was one of the best sellers straight from the first issue. And it's weirdly one of those that's gone under the radar, but also incredibly successful. So,
which is always weird, isn't it?
If there is a volume 2, I'm sure, you know, it's not going to, you know, it's going to be just as good as this at the very least.
Yeah. No, that was a very pleasant surprise. Like I say, I'd read that facsimile of My Greatest Adventure is 80. Mm. So when you said, let's cover the new Doom Patrol, I was like, all right, go on, we'll give it a go. Oh, man, I'll let.
But this was fun, you know. Like, I've not really made any secret of the fact that I'm not keeping up. My monthly pile keeps piling up. I'm still buying comics, I'm just not reading this. But this was the one that was just fun to read every month.
It's good. There's some good ads in this. The Return of Superman, 30th anniversary special. We've got that.
I've got that. I don't have the Death of. I think it's sold out.
Right, I'll see if I can find that for you in a cheapo bin. I did find it in a pound bin once and I was going to get it, and I could have swore right. You'd said,
no.
I've ordered it, so I put it back.
No, I went to pick it up, but they only had the facsimile of the Death of. Oh, it's right. Sold out of the anniversary one, but not the reprint.
No, the facsimile of Superman 75. There's a Batman Detective Comics ad. I've not read Detective Comics in years. Which, I read something really weird about that on the back issue market. Batman always sells Detective Comics, not so much.
Maybe it's the name that sells it.
Possible. And there you go, Aquaman 2. Oversized one shot.
It's a nice Ivan Reis.
It is.
Poster.
It's Ivan Reis cover, excuse me. But that there is no cup in the world that could hold how interested I am in Aquaman 2. Yeah. So we'll bin that. That's it.
That is it.
That was good, that.
It was.
We do heartily recommend that Doom Patrol comic. And that one went pretty much how we thought it would be.
I do think the trade is out now, so that's available to
is that out as
anyway.
Well?
Yeah.
Right, okay. So the trade paperback for the Unstoppable Doom Patrol. We need to get kicked back.
We do.
We've just plugged the Enfield Gang Massacre trade.
Yeah.
Now we're plugging the Unstoppable Doom Patrol trade. Where's our kickback?
I know, yeah.
DC and Image. Not so much Marvel, because we've not really... looked anything
we should
done.
We should get free review copies of things.
We should. I should get free, you know, omnibuses. There's a guy on YouTube. He's a really good guy. He seems really nice. Does okay. These videos about
but
omnibuses.
But he gets free stuff and you don't.
Yes. He gets free stuff and I don't.
It's a reason to dislike people. I
think it's a very, very positive reason to dislike somebody.
It's like how I always wish that I could create something so successful that I got free merch. Like, you always see people who just like, oh, I got my comms for this. I got, oh, they've done a toy line of my creation and I got free ones. Where's my great success?
Yeah. You know? You've not worked on it yet.
I've not.
Still got time before you're 30.
It's that I really hope that one day my future self will come back in time and go, this is it.
Here's, you don't have to actually do any work.
Here is.
You millennial.
Here is the sports almanac.
Okay, next time. So we've given you a couple of things over the past couple of months to go and buy.
Yeah. Buy us something.
Buy us a cough. Never get bored of that. Pulp and Enfield Gang Massacre and now this. But next time we're going back into the past.
Samurai Jack.
Yes. No, we're not covering Samurai Jack. We're going to do all three. This is for the Cape crowd that have abandoned us.
Is it?
Because we've been covering stuff that is not Cape. We're going to look at J. Michael Straczynski's Superman Earth One trilogy. Which, by all accounts, is not available in its own trade paperback.
Haven't we covered this?
We did the first one.
Right, okay.
I want to now look at all three of them.
Retrospective.
Yes, because my recollection, and I haven't read them since they came out, but my recollection is he said there was only ever intended to be three.
Right.
My recollection is it felt like there was loads of places that could go, and they were indeed gearing up for that, and then for whatever reason it didn't happen.
Yeah, because none of them...
Man Earth 3 never carries on either.
None of them ever had more than three, and most of them only had one.
Yeah. Teen Titans had two.
Yeah.
Did Green Lantern? No, did
Green Lantern had one, I think.
And then obviously Batman, Wonder Woman and Superman all got three.
Yeah.
Batman and Wonder Woman have been reprinted in a complete compendium trade paperback. Superman has not. And yet, people wonder why we think DC has a bias against the first... and arguably greatest superhero. Just saying. All right, so next time, Superman Earth 1 will be coming in your ears. I love that never doesn't make you laugh. We'll see you next time. Everything's going to be fine. Goodbye. Oh, and email us. Take care.
Bye.
Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the Sci-Fi Cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to him. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/aleyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics coming in your ears. It's a date.